This morning we have the historians panel, and I'm going to let Dave do the formal introductions. I'll introduce first Dave O'Brien, who many of you are familiar with. He's the Loyola Professor of History at College of the Holy Cross, and for years has been carrying the Catholic Worker banner in the academic worlds with Mike True here in Worcester. And he's very famous for one line he says he's remembered for. It's the line about Dorothy that you all know. She's the most significant and influential person. So thank you, Dave, for that great line. A very good line. And with us today, we have a number of thinkers, sensitive interpreters of the Catholic Worker movement. And we're very blessed to have with us a number of luminaries in the great sky of Catholic Worker scholarship. And so among us are Nancy Roberts, and Nancy comes from the Albany area. And I met Nancy at the Hancock Shaker Village a couple years ago. We were giving a talk on Catholic Worker matters there. And also Mel Peel is here from Indiana. Mel wrote Breaking Bread, a great work on the history of the movement. Rosalie Riegel from Chicago, you know Rosalie's Studs Terkel-like interviews, which are very important in the history of Catholic Worker. And Dan McCannon, who's the new Ralph Waldo Emerson professor at Harvard Divinity School, coming from St. John's in Minnesota, who's written a new book on the Catholic Worker after Dorothy. So we're very happy to have you all with us. Thank you for being here. Okay?
Thank you very much. 47 years ago this September, I went out to Rochester, New York to go to graduate school in American political history, and I knocked on a door looking for a room and met a couple, a middle-aged couple with no children, who wanted me to take the room because I had a Notre Dame jacket on, and they were Catholic Workers. They introduced me to Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker, and out of such thing come vocations. Robert mentioned yesterday how your vocation gets shaped by these unusual providential kind of experiences. So I've always been enormously grateful to God for bringing me into touch with those people and through them with the Catholic Worker movement and so many wonderful people, including this great kind of people who carry on the tradition here in Worcester. Frank Kartheiser, who's here, is co-founder of the Mustard Seed, Donna at the Mustard Seed, Mike Boover, Scott and Claire down in Hartford, Chris and Jackie and Brian. But a word too, somebody, we just said a word for a moment, but Mike True. Mike said some family illness and hasn't been able to be with us as much as I know he would like, but Mike True has just been such an important guide for me. When we came to Worcester in 1969, I knew Mike True's name from the Catholic Worker newspaper and immediately went looking for him, and he introduced me to Worcester, and for all these years, almost 40 years now, has continually taught me things about peace. Mike, as you know, is an international peace activist. He's lectured on nonviolence all over the world, including Pyongyang, North Korea, when it was very dangerous to do that. And he continues to be active in that international kind of world of nonviolence. And he comes back from these trips to Asia and elsewhere with this great enthusiasm about the growth of interest in and practice of nonviolence across the globe. So a word of tribute to Mike. I know that everybody, many people here know of his wonderful, wonderful work. And with Dorothy and with Dan Berrigan, has worked with Dan Berrigan's works and the rest. So thanks to Michael. I have the easy job today, which is just to introduce this marvelous panel. I'll introduce them one at a time, so if people come in late, they won't have forgotten who they are. And then they're each going to speak for about 10 minutes from their area of expertise, and then we'll open up the floor, and I'll try to, as Robert did yesterday, when you ask a question, to repeat the question into the microphone so everybody can hear it. And continue to raise your hand if you can't hear, and we'll tell everybody to kind of, what did they say yesterday, eat the microphone to speak directly into it. Our first speaker is going to be Mel Peel. Mel is a professor of humanities and history and he's dean of the Christ College, which is the honors college at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And a little sidebar for Mel is that Mel and a group of colleagues at Valparaiso over the last 20, 25 years have made an enormous contribution to reopening the conversation about the role of religion in American undergraduate education. It's been a tremendous contribution, I think, that all of us who work in higher education have really benefited from. He's particularly known to us and valued by us because of his work, Breaking Bread, the history of the Catholic worker, especially its work on the years after World War II. And that book was reissued by University of Alabama Press last year, so it continues to be available to us. And as he says, he's a longtime observer and friend of the Catholic worker. He's a Lutheran, and he's a person who really has made an enormous contribution to our knowledge of worker history, and we're really glad to have him here in Worcester. Mel Peel.
Thank you. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be here. I'm just awed by this gathering and by the people here who do such tremendously important work. And I guess if you think about this in Peter Morin's old terms, this is probably one of the largest round table discussions in the history of the Catholic worker. And I noticed so many of the gatherings in the round form, just merely lacking the table. And I also know what it takes for people to become and remain Catholic workers. And very early on in the history of the movement, in the 1930s, this issue of how people became involved and stayed involved was very important. And if I may quote a bit from the book, which includes a quote about the relationship, how people became involved in the movement. Quote, the turnover rate among new workers was high, although once, quote, seasoned, most of the volunteers learned to cope with the singular problems of the Catholic worker way of life. Veteran Catholic workers learned what kind of newcomers would adapt to, quote, the work. Quote, one soon became skilled at judging how long people would stay with us, one veteran worker said. Usually, if a person came who was a bit indifferent or even skeptical of the work, then we could count on having him or her stay with us for quite a period of time. But if they arrived full of enthusiasm and gushing about our beautiful way of life, then it was a foregone conclusion that they would not last long. Well, that, in fact, was from the late Stanley Vishnewski. And I have to say, back longer ago than I care to remember, when I first became interested in Catholic Worker Matters and was reading from the newspaper and so on, and I went to the Tivoli Farm, Stanley Vishnewski was the person who I think gave me a feel for what Catholic worker life was and how it worked. And of course, he was a marvelous storyteller and had been with the Catholic worker for movement for very long. Back into the 30s, and that sense of telling the stories of those early days and sort of the characters and the history, I began to get a feel for that, and I have always honored that, and I think in the phrase here, it is still going on and extremely important. I should also say that my perspective, of course, here is very much that of a historian, a student of Catholic worker history, I guess I would say. I'm probably someone who knows more about the Catholic worker in 1938 than in 2008. And so I'm looking forward to Dan's perspective and learning from many of you all the time. And at the same point, I think it is very important that movements always remember their history and recover their history, even as they generate more history and move on. And certainly the church, the Catholic Church, and the Universal Church has a long tradition of a sort of dialectical relationship between the changes that always happen and the new environment, yet always returning to the roots and having that dialogue and interaction between the phrase is the charism, the gifts of the founders and us in our present. And I think that is one thing that the Catholic worker has done and I'm sure will continue to do even as the distance from those early days grows greater and greater. And so my little contribution here, I guess, is to mention from a kind of historian's perspective, and I'm an American historian by background, three elements that strike me as contributions that the Catholic worker really has made in, can't hear, oh, sorry, that the Catholic worker really has made in the widest possible historical terms. And the first is perhaps one that we almost now take for granted. But if you go back to what the church was back in the 20s and 30s before the Catholic Worker began, I think it's the element of Catholic lay leadership, Catholic lay initiative, the dignity and vocation of the laity as a central element of the church. And of course, by now, I think people growing up in the wake of Vatican II, that's almost like the oxygen. You just take it for granted. But in fact, that was a quite revolutionary thing, what the Catholic worker does. The laity were by and large seen in effect as second class citizens in the church. The church was a hierarchical perfect society, and you knew where laity were in that hierarchy. And so it was very revolutionary, and I think continues to be, to say that the laity have their own Christian calling and vocation in the world, and they shape that for themselves, and their own life in the world is it's a different vocation than that of those called to clerical or religious life, but it has all the dignity. And the life of the world, the life of the church in the world, really, is one thing that the Catholic worker brought. My little perspective on this that I think you might find interesting is that in the 1930s, particularly, of course, many of you know that many in the Catholic Church thought that Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement were some kind of communist infiltrators, subverting Catholicism by bringing in Dorothy Day's old radical movement here. And, you know, there were places where the Catholic Worker paper could not be distributed in the church, and so on. But if you look at the way outsiders viewed the Catholic Worker, their view was very much that the Catholic Worker, the communists, for example, thought that the Catholic Worker was part of a very elaborately conceived plot by the Vatican to hold on to the Catholic working class. And so there was a great suspicion of the Catholic Worker as, you know, people imagined that, of course, everything was controlled from Rome, and this was a kind of publishing this paper and starting this movement was a very clever strategy. And interestingly enough, almost all American Protestants who noticed the Catholic Worker in the 1930s and 40s thought exactly the same thing. This was a Vatican maneuver to hold on to the Catholic working class and thereby retain the authority of the Pope and the bishops and the church and so on. So I think that gives you a little bit of the perspective of how transformative movements like the Catholic Worker were long before Vatican II. And unless the Vatican strategies are far more long-term and subtle than I can recognize, I think, you know, now we would say, no, this was not a part of a secret strategy to manipulate Catholics. It really was an autonomous act by lay people. And I think that element of lay action and dignity in many respects, many students today, for example, just can't imagine that this was regarded as so unusual at the time, but it really was, and not to say that the Catholic Worker shaped Vatican II, but certainly that movement was far in advance of those developments. The second element that I think is very important, and that most people who've tried to understand and write about the Catholic Worker have recognized, is the unusual integration of traditional Catholic faith with active social engagement, social justice, openness to the modern world. Almost everyone imagines that these things historically have been contradictory, and that somehow this seems very strange, that you can simultaneously be deeply devoted to the church and its traditions and its creeds and its faith, and yes, even its bishops and hierarchy, and yet act autonomously on behalf of social justice, freedom, and so on. And I think that is part of the genius of Dorothy Day originally, and then the many other cradle Catholics and other convert Catholics who came into the movement, who sensed that the germ of the church was always in favor of these kinds of activities and movements. And yes, it would not always be easy to sort out how that would work, but the long history of the Catholic worker movement, it seems to me, and still shows that that kind of relationship has been sustained. And for a long time, there were commentators, I think, both inside Catholicism and outside, who said, one of these days, they're going to have to pick or choose. They're either going to have to become a kind of, you know, very rigid sect under Catholic control, or form a kind of what was called a lay institute or something and get themselves straightened out under the church control, or they're going to have to abandon the Catholicism, or, you know, something that won't be recognized as Catholicism. And that there were a lot of predictions of that, and, you know, constant expectations that one of those things was going to happen, or that the religion would gradually drift away. There was an old French writer who said, what begins in mysticism ends in politics. And the idea that you would finally end up with a political movement, but without the spiritual component. And yet we see here sessions on prayer, worship, and so on. So I think that prediction has been proved false over these many years, and that it has been the strength of the Catholic worker movement to continuously return to its sources in the great church, in its Catholic roots, and yet look at that from a different perspective than many others have had. And the final one I'll just mention as a perspective is the relationship between Catholic worker, Catholicism, and American tradition. And this is something that my great friend and mentor David O'Brien has written a great deal about. But I do think, if you think about the long history of the church, it's really quite extraordinary to have this movement that is so has been so powerful and influential be rooted here in our modern American 20th century soil. When many people think of the saints and the great movements and orders of the church, I guess you're thinking of things out of the Middle Ages or, you know, 17th century France or something, and people who seem, I mean, interesting but quite different from us. And when I was listening to Bob Ellsberg's statement yesterday about the possible canonization of Dorothy Day, a fascinating subject, I thought, you know, if Dorothy Day is ever named a saint, I'm sure she's going to be the only one whose father was a sports writer, you know. And I mean, that's just indicative of the fact, and part of the appeal to me was always that she grew up in a very Midwestern American environment. Dorothy herself embodied many of the old American traditions. And I think this way in which that kind of modern American experience to now have something that connects to this ancient tradition in our modern age is really quite extraordinary. In many respects, Dorothy Day and I think many of the others brought the best of the great American traditions of social justice, equality, and especially freedom. I think if there's one element, of course, that we think of our country standing for, it's liberty or freedom or autonomy. And that component, while certainly not absent in the history of the church, you know, is something that we kind of know in our bones by virtue of our culture. And yet, how is that going to relate to the tradition of the church? And so I think it's been part, again, of the genius of the Catholic worker to say we can be completely free, autonomous, but we're using our freedom for different ends than what many of our fellow Americans think of. When they talk about freedom, it becomes a kind of self-assertion or getting to choose what I want. And here you have a movement that incorporates so much of American tradition and yet does that on behalf of the gospel ideals of losing your life to gain it and service to others. And so that are just a couple of my conclusions. Again, it's been a very great honor to be here. I think, you know, again, if you think about the long history of the church and the long history of many of the religious movements and orders of the church, 75 years seems like a pretty long time. I mean, if you think back to that year 1933, Father Carl, I hate to say it, but you know, that was a while ago. and yet here this movement is still going. Yet from another perspective, maybe these are still the very early days of the Catholic worker. If you think of the medieval movements and the Dominicans and the Franciscans and the Jesuits. So this is the very beginning years. And in several hundred years, people may look back and say, wow, those early Catholic workers there in the 21st century, what were they up to? And so on. And so I'd just like to conclude on a note that I've always liked in Acts 5. There's this interesting tale there about where the question is whether there should be launched a sharp persecution of the Christian movement to suppress it and drive it out. And some people are advocating that, indeed, it should be cracked down upon. And the great rabbi Gamaliel says, no, don't do it. If this is a human movement, you need not worry because it will sputter out on its own. It'll fritter out on its own. So you don't have to persecute it. And if it comes from God, no matter what you do, it will survive. So I join everyone here in praying that the Catholic worker is, in fact, from God, as we know it is, and that it will long survive. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mel. The Americanness of the worker, of course, was one of the great things about Michael True. Michael would give these slideshows, and he had a slideshow on American literary radicals that would end up with Dorothy Day. And he had a slideshow on American radicals in general from Tom Paine, was one of his favorites, all the way through to Dorothy Day and Ammon Hennessy's One Man Revolution. So Michael was always trying to persuade all the rest of us that we should always see them in a tradition of American radicalism and American protest. I did want to just say a personal word before introducing Nancy, that I had my little list of people thanking the Catholic worker, thanking all of you for your witness, thanking the Lancers who I met in that house in Rochester, and then I ticked off my Worcester friends, but I think I may have left out Donna. And Donna's cooked us all these wonderful meals, and Donna is just great, and thanks to Donna. Nancy Roberts is our next panelist. Nancy is now the head of the journalism program at the State University of New York at Albany, where her classes include the history of journalism and war in the media. Before that, for over 20 years, she taught at the University of Minnesota. Her books include, their first book was Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Paper, a study of the paper and Dorothy as a journalist. And then later, with her friend and our friend Ann Clement, She published a book called American Catholic Pacifism, The Influence of Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement, which won the Pax Christi Award for the best book that year on peace. And she's also published American Peace Writers, Editors, and Periodicals, a dictionary. Lately, she's been studying the journalism of the 19th century UNITA, a utopian community. Nancy Roberts.
Can you hear me okay? Yeah. I have to practically eat the microphone, right?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Now, my problem is I can't see you very well because I left my reading glasses in the car. And I'm wondering, I know I can speak without notes, but if someone has a pair of cheaters, I'd love to borrow them. Anybody? Oh, thank you.
Okay, God bless you. Back here.
Just what I needed. Thank you. Well, let me say with Mel and the other panelists that it's a great honor to be here, and I feel humbled by the company that I'm in. Yesterday, I spent some time looking around at the exhibits and, just hanging out and seeing what was going on. And it seems like just yesterday we were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Catholic Worker, and now we're at 75. And where did that time go? But, there are more than 200 houses now, right? On the website it says 185, but I think it must be over 200. I've lost track of how many newspapers are being published out of Catholic Worker houses. Plus, many of them have an online component, website and so on. I mean, it's very vibrant, I think, and still clearly going on. I've been thinking about it over the years and larger terms, in terms of American radicalism and American alternative journalism especially, which, as you know, is my special interest. And I just have a few comments about that might be of interest to you. But I do see the Catholic Worker as part of a long tradition of journalism in the United States that thrives in times of crisis. And we have, in part, our First Amendment to thank for that, you know, unrestricted freedom of speech and press, unprecedented in the world. We also have, I think, the American tradition of, you know, being a city on a hill and trying to be an example for all. The idea of society being, in this country, that it's perfectible, that you can find the way to improve it. I would start with the revolutionary period, getting back to Tom Paine, you know, as Michael True did, as one of the earliest American revolutionaries. In some ways, Dorothy Day follows in the footsteps of Tom Paine, who also recognized that the way to change public opinion is to put out a newspaper, get people reading about it, communicate. In fact, you could say that the way that the press started in the United States was really, it was an alternative press first in the Revolutionary Age. Those patriot pamphleteers, Sam Adams, Tom Paine et al., they recognized the importance of communication. There's such a long tradition in the United States of this. I could skip to the antebellum period, which is a period right before the Civil War that I've been very interested in lately, and look at all the different groups, especially peace advocacy groups, temperance advocates, suffragists, abolitionists, all of them looking to remake society and harnessing the press. There was a newer technology then of much speedier printing presses, and after about 1820 or 1830, mass production of media messages was possible. All these reformers turned to the press as a way to get their ideas out. Then when you get into the late 19th century and the muckraking period, Lincoln Steffens, Ida Tarbell, Ray Standard Baker exposing Standard Oil, their monopolistic practices and exploitation of workers. Or you think of the works of Upton Sinclair on the meatpacking, unregulated meatpacking industry. This was a period of real crisis in American life. I mean, my favorite example to give my students to help them imagine it is to say, many of them are at SUNY Albany or from downstate New York City, to say, can you imagine a time when New York City had raw sewage in the streets? That usually gets them to pay attention. But it was very difficult time in the United States, a lot of stresses and strains, and there's just a flourishing of journalism in this period, a lot of it alternative press, an alternative to the mainstream press that tries to show what's really going on. And then, of course, you look at the 1930s, the Great Depression. I mean, it's no accident that the Catholic Worker rose so quickly as an answer for many people in that period, in the 1930s, as did a lot of other reform journalism, including, there's such a long list of other radical writers and editors in that period. And I think of Mary Heaton Vorse, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, you know, writing about the striking iron workers on the Mesabi Iron Range in northern Minnesota, Agnes Smedley, Anna Louise Strong. One of the things that's really interesting about that period, which really saw a lot of reform journalism and radical journalism flourishing, is how many women picked up the pen or the typewriter, as it was in those days. It was journalism that was a way for them to contribute to radical movements in a period which was still pretty gender segregated and thought that women were better providing infrastructure, childcare, cooking, and so on, and that they should not be speaking in public. But you could write while you were stirring that pot on the stove. And that's why so many women writers in the radical movement really took off in that period. It was something they could do. And I think that Dorothy Day is part of that tradition. Before she died, I think it was probably a dozen years ago, the great Midwestern writer Marital Le Sueur, who lived in communal households in the upper Midwest throughout the Depression and beyond, and was blacklisted in the 1950s for her radical ideas. I was able to talk with her about the 30s, and she said, oh yeah, I knew Dorothy Day. She would, you know, come out here every now and then to the upper Midwest, and we were all kind of sisters, you know, all of us journalist types, who were out there trying to expose some of the excesses of capitalism. So there's that period that's a real flourishing of radical journalism. It's also a period when, in mainstream journalism, interpretive reporting, which is what it sounds like, more in-depth reporting with a lot of context, that really burgeons in that period too. You get into the 1960s, of course, all hell broke loose. You think of the, social, political, cultural disarray, and journalism just flourishes, especially the alternative press. In those days, you know, using the limits of technology, a lot of the alternative or underground presses were mimeographed. You young folks probably don't know what a mimeograph machine is, but you do? Okay. It was a very unwieldy way to crank out your message. I mean, you would literally be an ink-stained wretch trying to put out a mimeograph publication. I have a small collection of some of those papers, including many college papers that were published then, to oppose the Vietnam War, some of the other excesses of capitalism. The other thing that happened in that period, it's a real flowering of what we call literary journalism, which is a way of writing factually verifiable articles and commentary that tries to use all the literary methods traditionally associated with fiction writing to get at a larger truth about human existence, much the way a novel would. And some examples might be Tom Wolfe, Radical Chic, and Mao Maoing the Flat Catchers, or Norman Mailer's Armies of the Night, Joan Didion's Slouching Towards Bethlehem. This kind of writing had been around for a long time. In fact, Dorothy Day was doing it in the 1930s and earlier, but it really flourished in the 1960s, given what else was going on in society. And so I see the Catholic Worker as part of this long tradition of journalism flourishing in time of crisis, particularly alternative press that tries to take a critical look at society and particularly at government. So the question is, what about contemporary society? We have this crazy war going on. In fact, in a couple weeks, I'm going to make a very strange segue and go to the Army War College for a week. They invite professors, and I guess I must represent the peace studies wing of the professoriate, but I'm going to sit in on their seminars with the cadets on irregular warfare and chime in and see what they're teaching. I've been told that it's a very interesting perspective to get if you teach classes on war in the media, which I do. I'll certainly speak up for the other side. But this is irregular warfare, and this war, I mean, we could speak at length about it, but you know, how much of an impact is it having on people? My students are very interested in it. If there were a draft, I think they would be even more interested in it. Probably more likely, it's this recession that we're in, an economic downturn, I think, that might really make people pay attention when they find that gas is so expensive they can't commute as they normally do. I mean, it calls into question some very up-close and personal aspects of our lives. And I think, you know, in this kind of milieu, I think that the Catholic Worker can continue to flourish. In fact, I think it becomes increasingly relevant in today's society. I was very pleased to see on the table up there an article written for PETA, the Radical Animal Rights Group, by a priest about Christianity and vegetarianism, which is something I've thought about for a long time. But he makes the point that it's linked to, you know, the economic downturn, I mean, global poverty, all these issues. I mean, it has some relevance, and I thought that's really kind of a new perspective to see. Allied with PETA, of all organizations, I think of them as sometimes fomenting violence because of their tactics. But it's a thoughtful approach to a contemporary issue. That's just one of many. I think the Catholic Worker will continue, and as Mel said, you know, people will look back and say, so, in the 21st century, what were those Catholic workers up to? What were they thinking? And I think the key is maybe continuing to make it a unique voice that addresses the pressing problems of the age in a thoughtful way. I was really excited to see the newspapers that people have left here, the paper copies. I've looked at the websites as well, and I would say A+, still going strong. I mean, one of the things that's hard to balance is how much homage do you pay to the founders, Dorothy and Peter, in terms of reprinting material, that's always been a component of the Catholic Worker. It seems like every issue that I see of just about any house's newspaper, Catholic Worker, has some reprint, and it's good to do that. At the same time, I mean, there are newer, younger voices that are finding, I think, a fresh way to address some of the movement's challenges, and I think that's the real key, is to make it your own and to say it in your own way. And that's why it's so heartening when I look out here to see all these young people who are not retiring baby boomers, but who've been, you know, associated with the work for a long time, but people in their 20s and 30s and little kids being raised in the Catholic Worker household. And I would say, to me, that's the most encouraging sign of the continuity of it, to look at the age range here in this group and see a lot of the veterans and a lot of young people who are now veterans as well. I think it will continue as long as it continues to have people who will do the work and also articulate what it means to larger group of readers. One of the things that I'm really interested in is how much technology might change the way the message is communicated. It seems a long time ago that the New York House was having and heartfelt debates about whether to use computers to address the labels on 100,000 subscriptions. And that day seems very long ago. There's, you know, especially with younger folks, there's more willingness, I think, to use the technology, not to be seduced by it, but to use it. You know, it's just another tool. And I see more and more of that, and I think that, you know, if you could find a way to text message it, the Catholic Worker, you'd reach my students. They probably do that more than anything. You know, it's their main source of news, it seems. But I see the Catholic Worker as a very fluid, flexible kind of institution that keeps the basic message is still there. It's still what it was in 1933, but seems to be able to creatively adapt to contemporary issues and sensibilities. So I would encourage, especially, and applaud all the young people who are here. In fact, I think we should give them a round of applause. And just invite them again to think about what would you like to do with the Catholic Worker, not only the movement, but the newspaper. What could you say in your own way in 2008 that would reflect your experiences, you know, as a younger person, saying something about the state that we are in. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nancy. Michael Boover has already said the best thing that could be said about our next speaker, Rosalie Riegel, that she's the Studs Terkel of the Catholic Worker movement. Rosalie Riegel co-founded two Catholic Worker communities in Saginaw, Michigan. Her publications include Voices of the Catholic Worker in 1993, Dorothy Day, Portraits by Those Who Knew Her in 2003. She's, like me, a professor emerita of English from Saginaw State University. She's a grandmother of seven. I only have five, but may catch up soon. She currently lives in Evanston, Illinois, and St. Helen, Michigan, where she's working on her latest oral history, Doing Time, Nonviolent Activists Speak Out for Peace. Rosalie.
Well, as you can probably tell from the amount of talking I've done in the last couple days, I'm thrilled to be here, especially to meet so many new people. I mean, I know a lot of people in the room, but I've just been thrilled to meet new people. I'm thrilled that we were joined by Bernd and Sabine from Germany, and I'm just wonderful to be here. The work I do is as a shaper of your words, not my words, but your words. So I'll be shuffling papers as I go along so that I can pick out quotes to just demonstrate a few things on the assignment David gave me, which is, and I think it was a very apt one for the oral histories, what does the Catholic Worker mean to individual people? So I will be, and I'll try to remember to put them in just a little bit of context. As I said, I just went through Voices. It was a piece of cake, and picked several sort of seminal ideas of what the Catholic worker meant to people. I will say, as kind of an umbrella thing, for almost everybody that I've interviewed, and I think it's probably 350 people or so by now, their Catholic worker time, whether it's forever or, you know, just a temporary time, was probably the most important part of their life. Just as I think Robert said yesterday about Dorothy, got him started on his life. Most people when I met who'd met Dorothy said that was kind of one of the high points of their life, and the Catholic worker generally has been that. In the beginning particularly, and Dorothy usually referred to this, people think, I think, look to the Catholic worker as a school, as a place of learning, but not in the traditional sense. I think some of us still have kind of a negative feeling about school. The Catholic worker as school was fun and exciting and vibrant. As Justine Murphy said, she was one of the co-founders of the first Catholic worker in Detroit. It was mind-boggling. You come from kind of a one-dimensional Catholic schoolgirl upbringing, and you come to New York City, and all of a sudden you're meeting all these luminaries of Catholic social thought. As Nina Moore said, now Nina Moore, as many of you know, actually she's kind of responsible in a way for this conference, because she gave so much money to the 2006 conference that we had some left over. Nina was one of Dorothy's dear friends, came from Milwaukee, started the Milwaukee Catholic Worker, spent most of her life in Chicago. Never could really live a Catholic worker life. She used to kid, she kept a quilt on her stove. I mean, Nina liked restaurants. She never could really live in the grittiness of the Catholic worker. But she was a Catholic worker in her absolutely boundless hospitality at the Scheele Center, which was a wonderful Catholic bookstore, for years. Traveled with Dorothy. She said New York was just so exciting to sit at the stoop of, it was way before Mott Street, in the early days of the worker in the 30s, and look at all the people that came by to see Dorothy, Sigurd Unstad and Father Judd, and all these people who were really contributing to Catholic social thought. And Mel referred to this, the Catholic worker has always been a lay movement. While we've had wonderful priests and religious who have and still are part of the movement, Dorothy and Peter taught us how to be lay Christians, how to be Christians in the world as a lay thing. So for people that were growing up, and I'm old enough so I remember this, in a church where lay people were basically expected to pray, pay, and obey, the Catholic worker was really mind-boggling. Ed Marciniak was one of the co-founders of the early Chicago group. And he said, I remember when I stumbled upon the Catholic worker, it was a revelation. And he used to leave three of them on the L. But he said, what excited him was that people personally went into a hospitality, not third hand, not by giving money, but that they personally did the weeks of mercy. He too used the word mind-boggling. And then he said something that I think is another very meaningful aspect of the Catholic worker to many. He said, the Catholic worker would raise issues and people could kind of pick and choose among them. And then those issues would sometimes be farmed out to different things. This is something for anybody that's looking at for a dissertation would be a really nice thing to look at. What issues in the worker have been picked up by other examples? One that I remember particularly because I was so crazy about him was John Court, who he didn't buy the whole Catholic worker line, as he said. He met Dorothy over here at Boston when he was going to Harvard, and he was first attracted by her wit and the sparkle in her eyes, and he said, you know, if somebody's having that much fun, I better go get some of it. But he kind of early on went into the labor movement and was very active in Catholic labor community. So he picked that part of the worker. And some people, and I think this still happens, what's meaningful for the worker for many people now are specific aspects. We kid sometimes and we talk about full-service workers who do hospitality and resistance and have a garden. But many people of necessity concentrate and follow their passion. Dorothy and Peter, but Dorothy particularly, encouraged people to follow the passion. And because of the amorphous nature of the worker, people were able to do that. They'd come to learn. They'd find often what their passion was. Sometimes they would leave. Increasingly, as you know, they stay. Many people, I'm thinking of Donna DeMiziano and many others, would learn from the worker, but maybe not particularly in a way they thought when they came. What was meaningful to the worker for them was learning from the guests, learning for people who come from very different backgrounds than many of the people who come to the worker to work. I think one thing I just want to say here, and I don't have a quotation for it, but I think we all come to the worker with needs, no matter what label anybody puts on us. We come because we need something, and I'll come back to that at the end. Tom Lumpkin, who is a priest Catholic worker for over 30 years now in Detroit, and said the Mass at the last gathering, he said, I'm learning here, being here, a profound respect for an individual and their feelings, in contrast to ideas, principles, intellectualizations of things. Of course, Catholic workers traditionally have done a lot of that intellectualizing. But Tom said, and as I said, he had this theological background, in addition, I've gained a strong respect for instincts, intuitions, gut feelings. And he also spoke very movingly of learning of his flaws, of feeling he was pretty much a nonviolent person when he was a priest in a parish, and of just sort of learning of the depths of his violence and how much not really living a life of nonviolence required the practice and the daily renewal, which is, by the way, you see that a lot in the Dorothy Day's diaries, The Duty of Delight. So people came to the worker, and the worker meant to them, for them, a school in humility, a school in the intellectual underpinnings of the worker, a school of Catholic social thought. For a lot of workers, and I kind of invite all of you to just sort of think of this and how you relate, what the Catholic worker means to them seems to be enthusiasm, as Willa and Brendan's newspaper has, that the Catholic worker is a great adventure. Jeff Dietrich, and he gave me the first interview, said, there's such a sense of participating in this great adventure. Dorothy was a part of the progressive, heroic struggle to make our nation a better place, and I think you've heard wonderfully from my first two speakers about how the Catholic worker fit into that, and to keep alive the light of justice and liberty. She lived in Greenwich Village and actually knew Eugene Debs and Emma Goldman and Jack Reed. I get chills whenever I think I'm part of that. You know, it was wonderful also to hear from Dorothy of the rich tradition of brokenness and sinfulness and scandal that those in the Catholic worker come from. We're so less than perfect, but we're called by this incredible ideal. So Jeff saw that not only is the Catholic worker part of the larger American progressive movement, but it's also part of itself. We're all somehow part of each other in the mystical body. John Williams, who came to the Worker as a convert, as do many, his sense of tradition was that we're part of the larger Catholicism, part of earlier movements in France or Europe, the distributists, the anarchists, the European social movements, and also the very exciting times of the church that predated Vatican II. Many of the early Catholic workers were very proud that they were doing tradition, liturgical innovation before Vatican II, that they were thinking of home liturgies. I'm thinking of Julian and Mary Jane Pleasants of Notre Dame, who were part of the first South Bend Catholic Worker, and then they lived in an agrarian community in back of Notre Dame, and lived very simply, raised their children ecologically, somehow Julian managed to be a chemistry professor and still plow, and really had a tremendous enthusiasm that they were cutting edge laity, Catholic family movement, all these things that predated Vatican II, gave them a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for being part of a new tradition. But almost all of these older folks, like Joe Zarella, who was the one of Dorothy's earliest helpers and then spent most of his married life in the Midwest, as he said, it was exciting. Never, never a dull moment. Always exciting. And then he went on to brag kind of about the poverty, and it was really poverty. I mean, I think we tend to forget this, what it was really like to always be trying to get the grocer on the corner to give you a little more credit because you just really had to pay the newspaper printer a little bit to keep the newspaper to come out. I mean, it was really, you know, I think all of the houses struggle in some ways, but the absolute destitution poverty, I think, was much greater in the early years. And people that lived through that were proud of the fact that they lived through that. As Mary Alice Sorella said, you know, the bugs didn't really bother us. They just, they bothered me. But, you know, they were proud of the fact that they could jump out of their middle class life into this. When Gary Alvaro came to the, excuse me, I'm not sure it's Gary. Hold on a minute. It's Gary Donatelli. He came to the Worker in the, Brian, what, six, late 60s? 70s. 70s. There were three men came to the Worker at, well, they all thought it was the golden age. Tom Cornell said, you know, I was there in the 50s, that was the golden age. You know, the workers, wherever you were, that's the golden age. And I think I kind of, maybe I'm a little not marching in that, to that drummer, because I think now's the golden age. I think the last 5 years or so, and I'm not living in a house now, I see such a tremendous vitality, and that's why I'm looking forward to Dan's analysis of contemporary workers. But anyway, Gary was thrilled when he came to the New York house. I was thrilled. It was everything I wanted, and then some. Squalor, dirt, poverty, bedbugs, the works. There wasn't a clean sheet in the house. But what he really saw was the Catholic Worker as more honest than many of the religious orders in those days, who talked the talk but didn't walk the walk. And for many of the workers, walking the walk was what was meaningful for them. As Tom said, Tom Cornell, I saw an integrity at the Worker, a spiritual integrity, an intellectual integrity, and an evangelical integrity that I did not find anyone else. This is what the church ought to be. And then he says, of course, that was the golden age. But those three points, intellectual, spiritual, and evangelical, The evangelical, I don't know whether there's a Catholic work around the world that even evangelizes, but we evangelize by our lives, you know, by what we do. Many people came, and for many people, the Catholic worker means a place to be a Christian with some depth, not to be a Sunday Catholic or a Sunday anything, but to be a real Christian, to believe, whether or not it's a Christian belief, but to live in communion with your ideals. It's a place for that, a space for that. And as we see, a space for people to follow their own conscience, to live according to their own ideals and not to have to follow a party line. The aims and means, I think there isn't anybody that would disagree with them, but the way the individuals live them out is something else. During the Vietnam times, I think people went, what the worker meant to them was a sometimes a chance to be radical and safe. The nonviolence kept a lot of us during the Vietnam times on an even keel, thank God for Dorothy, you know, because I think it really kept a lot of the peace movement from going bananas. John Williams told me that you could get the Peacemaker's paper when he was in prison, but you couldn't get the Catholic Worker. They wouldn't let the Catholic Worker in. So that appealed to him. He said, I got to check this out. but Bill Griffin told me that the Catholic Worker, to him, represented some space where there still were ideals in American life, and I think that was important during Vietnam. For most people, the Catholic Worker meant community. Sometimes being in the Catholic Worker, even today, means an abrupt leaving of family. Not all of us have these wonderful large families like Bernie Gilgun. He told me that his Catholic Worker life and his family life would just all sort of blend together. Many people have had family breaks, and Kathleen Rum said, the Catholic Worker was family to me. Just as many people said, Catholic Worker to me meant church. Michael Harrington's famous line, the Catholic Worker was as far left as I could go and still be in the church. The Catholic Worker as church, I think most people maybe come to think that. Come thinking that, maybe don't remain thinking that, but it's a way to live with integrity. But for most people, Catholic Worker is community. It's family. It's a place to love, a place to be loved, a place to learn to love sometimes kind of unlovable people. A place to find value, as Lynn LaSalle Klein, a young Catholic worker, and not so young anymore, 80s young, a place to not flail around, but to find value and commitment, to make connections between what you think politically and what your heart feels. For many, it was a spiritual home. For many, it's an actual home. Margaret McGee, who was a blind psychiatrist, I believe, from this area, told me that when she met Dorothy Day, or she told me she always felt a little weird, always felt like an oddball. But then when she met Dorothy Day, she felt that she had met a kindred spirit, and that she had never felt as at home in her life. Many of the people in the Catholic Worker, including myself, have never felt more at home than with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rosalie. Our next speaker is Dan McCannon. Dan is joining the faculty of Harvard Divinity School. Mike said he's the Ralph Waldo Emerson Professor. Well, there's even more to it than that. He's the Ralph Waldo Emerson Unitarian Universalist Association Senior Lecturer in Harvard Divinity School. That's pretty good. He's actually in the process of moving to Cambridge now, and apologize for not being able to be with us yesterday. His first book, Images of God, was about radical Christians and nonviolent power in antebellum United States. And he's then wrote two further books, Touching the World, Christian Communities Transforming Society, and most recently, The Catholic Worker After Dorothy, Practicing the Works of Mercy in a New Generation. Those two books deal with the Camp Hill and Catholic Worker networks of international communities. Dan's current book project, tentatively entitled Prophetic Encounters, is a general history of the religious left in the United States. His first direct encounter with Catholic Worker community was the St. Catherine of Genoa AIDS Hospice in Chicago in the mid-1990s. He has spent time in about 15 Catholic Worker communities as part of his research. It's good to have Dan with us.
Thank you so much to all of you for welcoming me and everyone to another wonderful gathering of the Catholic Worker family. I am so sorry that I won't be able to be with you for more than just this morning. I always hate it when people come to conferences and speak and then leave before they have a chance to listen, but I'm unfortunately in the position of doing that. I'm heading off to my sister's wedding tomorrow, about 50 miles from here. I'd like to share a general observation and then three things that I hope will be at least a little bit provocative. General observation stems from a passage from Dorothy's diaries. I'm just beginning to dig into these. Thank you so much, Bob, for your work on this wonderful resource. And one of the themes that comes up again and again is a certain frustration that Dorothy had with her fellow workers. At one point she talks about her discouragement at, quote, such a lack of understanding of the personalist idea from those you expect the most from. Now what she's referring to here, of course, is not insufficient grasp of the intellectual subtleties of Peter Morin's or Emmanuel Monnier's ideas. What she's referring to is the fact that people are wanting her to boss them around and she doesn't want to do it. Well, she does want to do it, but she wishes she didn't want to do it. And it's driving her crazy that people keep expecting her to be the dictator, to be the anarch, as Tom Cornell said, of her anarchist movement. And the big story, I think, of the Catholic Worker movement is that all of you have grasped the personalist idea, that this has come about. That somehow thousands of Catholic workers, some over the course of a lifetime, some over the course of a summer, have figured out the way to do this movement in their own particular way while staying connected to so many others who are walking the same walk. And that's an amazing story in the history of social movements, that people have been able to go in so many different directions together. And I don't think I fully understand how that story came about. I think there's a lot more work that we all have to do in kind of comparing notes to figure out how this movement figured out personalism. I think part of it is Dorothy's respect for her own spiritual journey, her willingness to take that famous almost a year off from the movement early on, her devotion to her own work as a writer, her devotion to her relationship with her daughter and her grandchildren. All these things gave everybody else a little space from her, space to move in their own directions. And the other piece of the story that I just began to glimpse in my research, which I hope all of you will work at telling more fully, is the story of all the people, and many of you are sitting here in this room, who came to the movement, say, between 1965 and 1975. Rosalie's already invoked this whole golden age debate. This at least was the time when the movement was experiencing its most rapid expansion since the 1930s and its most enduring expansion. So many communities founded between 65 and 75 are still with us, still anchoring the movement in their particular region. And the other thing that I think is really interesting about the folks who came in those years, the final years of Dorothy's life, is that, as far as I can tell, none of you wanted to be the new Dorothy Day. If someone was wanting that at the time, let me know afterward. Yeah. But as far as I can see, you all wanted to be friends with one another and to learn from one another, to learn from Dorothy. And, you know, there have been so many movements. When the founder dies, there's this great succession battle, because everybody was just waiting in the wings to be that person. And the Catholic Workers, so many talented, so many charismatic people waiting in the wings to just keep on doing what they were doing. An amazing story to me. When I put together the second book, Catholic Worker After Dorothy, I knew that I didn't have the time or the energy to tell anything like the whole story. And so I hoped I would say a few things that would provoke debate. And I want to say them a little bit more sharply today in hopes of provoking debate, not necessarily this hour, but over the months and years to come. First point, the works of mercy are the only common denominator of this movement. Roman Catholicism is enormously important to the Catholic Worker movement, but as you all know, you don't have to be a Catholic to be a full participant in this movement. Nonviolence is very important to this movement, but you can be a member of the military and bring a plate of lasagna to your local Catholic Worker community, and it's going to get eaten. Voluntary poverty is something that so many people have discovered through this movement and have figured out how to live in beautiful ways. And yet, as Dorothy reminded people sometimes, the Catholic Worker lives in symbiosis with people living more conventional economic lives and donating money. And that's part of the story as well. But the works of mercy, directly seeing the person with whom you're breaking bread, is something that, if you haven't experienced that, you have not experienced the Catholic Worker. And what makes the Catholic Worker more than a charitable organization, I think, is that Catholic Workers use the works of mercy as a way of seeing the world. That you don't feed the poor as a way of getting rid of some responsibility. You feed the poor in order to be changed. That's what leads many people to voluntary poverty. That's what leads many people to radical pacifism. That's what leads many people to Catholicism, though ironically it's also what leads many people out of Catholicism, right? We know that for many Catholic Workers, practicing the works of mercy is the way that you discover the richness of the sacramental, of the Catholic sacramental tradition. And for many other Catholic Workers, the works of mercy become the only sacramental tradition needed. Why is there that diversity? I think that's one that only God knows, but it's an integral part of the story. The second, hopefully a little bit provocative thing I have to say is that the Catholic Worker is the meeting place for the whole Catholic Church and the whole of the American left. So call to action Catholics have always been a central part of this movement. Catholics who are deeply faithful to every detail of hierarchical teaching have always been central to this movement. The works of mercy provide a place for those kinds of Catholics to meet. But even more than that, the works of mercy provide a place for that whole spectrum of Catholics to meet anarchists, to meet communists, to meet anti-imperialists, to meet all sorts of other kinds of social change activists, and to transform the traditions of the American left just as much as the Catholic worker is transforming the Roman Catholic Church. Now, I think because of the process of canonization for Dorothy, because of David's famous quote, everybody knows that the Catholic worker is integral to the story of Roman Catholicism in the United States. I'm not sure if everyone knows how integral the Catholic worker is to the story of the American left. I don't know if we found the places to tell that story as clearly. I'm a religious historian, though I'm not a Catholic, so I definitely come more from that other side. Thank you. I can't remember the name of the person who sent me a postcard. Thank you about the industrial workers of the world rather than the international workers of the world. People who wouldn't make that mistake, I made that mistake in my book, people who wouldn't make that mistake need to be telling the Catholic worker story as well. And thank you, Nancy, for all the ways you were lifting up those connections to the American radical tradition. We need to be thinking as creatively about ways to challenge our brothers and sisters on the left today as we are thinking about ways to challenge the larger Catholic Church. My third provocative point is the point that I made in Touching the World, which is just as much about the Catholic worker as the Catholic worker about after Dorothy. It just doesn't have as clear a title. I'm just learning how to write titles. But the point I made in Touching the World is that the Catholic worker is transformative because it has low boundaries. Catholic workers live in really radically different ways from the larger society, but they're completely interwoven with the larger society, in large part through the extended community, all the people who come into your houses once a week or once a month and take some little piece of what's going on there into their everyday lives. That's vital to hang on to, and I think it will be held on to for a long time. So those are my three points, and the invitation I would make in conclusion would be that I hope that everybody who's part of the Catholic worker community will find your own story as worth telling as the Dorothy and Peter story. Again, picking up on the practice of including in Catholic worker newspapers a healthy dose of Peter and Dorothy every single time. I'm not going to say y'all should stop doing that, but find as many ways as you can, even if you think you're not quite the right kind of Catholic worker because you're not Catholic or not a pacifist or not whatever. Tell your story with the same vigor that Dorothy always told hers. Emulate her in that way as well as by reproducing her words. And that'll help, I think, everybody around us to see what a rich and transformative movement this has been and this will be for many years to come. Thank you.
Thanks to all four of our panelists for this very rich array of ideas and thoughts about the movement. The floor is going to be open now, and I'll try to repeat what you say so that everybody can hear it, and you can direct thoughts or questions to the whole panel or to any particular person. Yes?
I want to respond to Mel Peel. Mel, I believe too that Jesus has become the essence of the Catholic order, as each Catholic order has had a special charism in the church. I would say that spiritual freedom is the charism of the Catholic order, and the connection with Orthodox moral, Catholic moral theology is that without spiritual freedom,
The question was about spiritual freedom, a comment about spiritual freedom being at the heart of the Catholic worker experience and how important that is for the larger church, which has not always been able to experience that spiritual freedom. It was directed to Mel.
I think that's very important. And, you know, of course, the long history of paradox. I think that's very important, the long history of paradox with regard to freedom. I mean, the gospel statement is, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. In our American tradition, we have a lot of this. Freedom means you can't tell me what to do. And I think it's working out that notion that, yes, often people have not been able to understand or practice the truth of the gospel because it has appeared to be constrained upon them. And so then the natural movement is to say, well, I'm getting out of that, and I'm going off in my direction that I will shape my own existence. And I think Dorothy has a wonderful passage in Loneliness, I think it is, where she says something about, you know, I have tried every possible dimension of freedom that you could possibly imagine, and I finally felt like the little girl who got up every morning and said, do I have to do today again what I want to do? And that's why I think she found her ultimate freedom in the church. But for many others, of course, that sense, I think you're very right, to have that vocation of freedom, complete freedom, which, again, we, I think, absorb very deeply, and then conclude that, in fact, the greatest freedom is in the service of the gospel in the church is a very easy thing to say and difficult to grasp.
Great. Thank you. Yes.
My ears picked up especially when, as Nancy Roberts mentioned, PETA, and maybe perhaps they're fomenting violence. And maybe just said, I'd like you to rethink that, given that Bruce Friedrich, a Catholic worker, is the director of vegan outreach or something or other. But it reminded me of a recent situation of many Catholic workers doing a die-in at the Capitol. And in court, they were accused of fomenting violence. Their die-in might inspire an observer to do something violent, and it would have been their fault. So we're a seamless garment community, and then when you mentioned that maybe there are Catholic workers who are not pacifists, I'm like, oh my gosh, please be pacifists. And I think if Dorothy were here, she'd say, oh, please, you know, please, print it in the paper. If not, please leave, which she asked us. You know, if you're not going to hand out, we are still pacifists for that position, you're out. So I think we've got to, you know, sometimes it really frightens me when I think the Franciscans, the head military chaplain was a Franciscan priest. How did we get from Francis to the Marine chaplaincy? So I'm praying to God that we stay rooted in active, nonviolent resistance to all violence. And call in, PETA, thank God for PETA. You know, I don't want to kill any animals either. And they're holding that up really very well, in my estimation.
Okay, we're good.
Can you summarize? And next, people have questions, can use this mic.
Oh, okay. I'll try to just summarize briefly. That was kind of a plea for a kind of integrity within the movement, a kind of following on the movement's charism. But the particular question was raised about a comment about PETA and whether PETA is a group that stimulates violence, right?
Yes. Anyway, thank you for your comments. They're enlightening. I think that I'm getting educated now about what PETA is up to. I belonged to it years ago, but I stopped for a while because I thought that sometimes, it's a sticky question of property destruction. If you do that, for instance, in the old days at least, when they would go to an animal lab and release the animals, which I understand the animals didn't always know how to live on the outside, but they would release them, that it can maybe foment violence. In some ways, it's a small example. It's not really an exact parallel, but I think of the property destruction issues of the 1960s, early 70s during the Vietnam War, the Catholic worker where I think the Americans were advocating sometimes doing destructive things, property destruction, pouring blood on files, and they think, Dorothy said, well, I can't speak, ex-cathedra about this, but you run the danger of, if you're doing something physically violent, possibly fomenting that as well. Overall, I applaud Peter's attempt to give us a sort of Christian theology of nonviolence that extends to members of the animal world. I mean, there's a lot of reasons. You can link the practice of vegetarianism one way or another with some of the global economic issues. So I was actually celebrating that pamphlet being here. It's like, wow, this is not something that I had encountered before. So I guess I need to learn more about PETA and what they're up to, but it looks pretty good. I've been a priest to write about the theology of vegetarianism. It's great.
There is a microphone now for those that have a question. How about up here in back? Right there.
To the historians that are here, my sense is that when the worker started in 33,000 copies of the worker were handed out in Union Square, 1,500 copies. And I think, from what I can remember, by 38, there was reference to 80,000 subscribers. And I'm wondering if someone could speak or someone could speak to how did that happen? Was it Dorothy's notoriety? Was it, there wasn't TV, there wasn't email, obviously internet. How did the worker boom from those 1,500 copies on May Day in 33 to 80,000 subscribers? I'm just curious of people's perspectives on that. And just the other comment, I think that we have to be very careful about using the word violence. And some property has no right to exist, and I don't think that's violence.
Thank you.
I could start to answer the first question that you raised about how did the paper grow, and my colleagues, of course, probably had something to add to it, I'm sure. But it was grassroots. You said there was no television. Radio was still in its infancy. There was no internet, so there wasn't as much media competition. You didn't have a whole bunch of people busy talking on their cell phones and text messaging instead of reading. More people read stuff. But also, it was very grassroots, and it was, I think people were just really eager for solutions. It was a very much a crisis period, and there was something called the Catholic Order that tries to address the problems of the day. I think a lot of cadre of volunteers went out in Union Square and then beyond, and I think it spoke to the times. Today, if people launching a movement, would you do it by a penny a copy newspaper with wonderful wood engravings and so on. Well, I guess those came a little later. You'd probably do a website, it would probably be digital, I think, to have that kind of impact pick up so quickly. But, given the technology of the period, that was appropriate technology, and it was current, it was contemporary. But it was largely, a volunteer grassroots effort, which is the amazing thing about it.
I was just going to add, I think it was 2,500 copies on that first May Day, and they went very quickly, a penny a copy. And I think another key was that in the early days, as the movement spread, and of course it was a chicken and egg, the paper and the movement, but it was part of the task of every Catholic worker to go out and sell the Catholic worker newspaper on the streets. And so there was a lot of that, and then in the parishes too. They quickly moved to distribute this in parishes, and it's very interesting that back again, in the 30s, some priests and some dioceses were very enthused about having this sold in their parish, and others were extremely nervous, to say the least. So, and there's the famous stories, of course, about the Catholic Worker newspapers being on the street corners in New York City, and the communist people would yell, "Buy the Daily Worker," and someone else would shout, "Read the Catholic Worker daily." So that's the slogan.
Yeah, one other thing I'd add to that is that in the context of that moment, people were hungry for the message. Everyone knew the economy had fallen apart, and they were looking for new ideas about how to rebuild the economy, and the Catholic Worker had one.
Franklin Roosevelt had one too, and it was welfare state capitalism built on economic expansion through wartime military spending, and that's what we've had working more or less well for the past 75 years. We now know it doesn't work at all anymore. And this is, you know, another great moment to really lift up the Catholic worker economic vision, as well as the Catholic worker nonviolent vision. But I could also respond quickly to the point on nonviolence. Absolutely, the Catholic worker nonviolent witness is essential. But one of the things that's great about the nonviolent witness of the Catholic worker is you don't have to be a pacifist to get in the door, the way you have to be a pacifist to join the War Resisters League. And so to couple with that real welcome of the military person who wants to bring some lasagna and a strong nonviolent witness, that's the special gift of the Catholic worker.
Thank you. Over here.
My question to the panel was, I've wondered if Peter's three-pronged vision for the worker, where you think... My question to the panel was, with Peter's three-pronged vision for the worker, the agronomic university's clarification of thought and houses of hospitality, if you think that developed out of the utopian community sentiments of the 1800s, out of scripture, or from some other venue, and where he came up with those ideas.
I mean, speaking specifically of Peter Boren, he developed those notions out of his own understanding of traditional European Catholic social thought. So he was really bringing his own interpretation of a much older understanding of Catholic, what was interpreted as Catholic social thought, and distilled into those 3 points. So in that sense, the Catholic worker, you know, was drawing on a longer Catholic tradition that was not as widespread in this country, I think, in the same way. And in that sense, for example, seeing it, as Ben said, as the practice of the works of mercy as an absolutely central element of identity was a fairly, to really understand it, and certainly to interpret it in those terms out of Matthew 25, it was a very different idea than most, quote, American folks had.
Hi, I'm Tess. Can you hear me?
This is just kind of an addendum to that question, but I thought it was interesting in Dorothy's diaries that she didn't mention reading all these people that I have read, Mounier, Grugiev, and the French, she was very close to the Maritans, but a lot of the European thinkers. Dorothy read a lot of Russian novels, as we all know. And the next time I read her diaries, I'm just going to make a list of all the books she mentions. And I know that Robert told me that he left out, when he had to leave out a lot of everything, he would leave out sometimes quotations from books, but she had some very interesting summaries obscure books and books that we all should be reading.
Here we go, we'll use this one.
Hi, Tekka from St. Louis Karen House. Wanted to respond, especially to Danny, to your comment. Since you're provocative, I thought we should give you a response. I first just really loved your book, really grateful for it. I read it on the way up here, I really liked it a lot. Wanted to say that I was thinking in response to the sort of centrality of the works of mercy.
Right into it.
That, I agree with you that they're absolutely essential. But I do think that actually all the tenets of the worker kind of combine together, really form the Catholic worker. And even though like there's a lot of ambiguity, personalism permeates it all, I think, because we take the lasagna from the military man because we're personalists. And so I think, I just want to say that I think at different times we might be stronger in one thing, stronger in another. Different houses are stronger in one than another. But in my own life, I've been weak in something, and someone new has come to the community and given me strength in the area and kind of reminded me of our central vision. So I just want to make that comment. And about the relationship with the church, we're going to solve that this afternoon.
I'll ask the questioners to speak right. right into that microphone, right up in your mouth.
Thanks, Pekka. I don't have too much to say in addition to that. I guess one of the things you're helping me to see is that, to say the works of the mercy are the only common denominator is not to say that they're the only important thing. You know, there are lots of things that aren't complete common denominators, that the movement wouldn't be the movement without those things.
Next. Right into it.
I'm Meg Broadhead, and just two brief points. I participated in a Plowshares action in 1986 with regard to the controversy about that kind of method of direct action. It is certainly the case that there are certain kinds of property that have no right to exist. But having said that, does it exhaust the question of whether destroying that property entails some element of violence? And I think that's really, one of the controversies, one of the questions that is alive for this movement. It's the right kind of question to wrestle with. Next question to the panel. I don't think I heard any of you mention Christian anarchism. And of course, that's something we'd all be very interested to hear any of your comments about.
There was a mention of, that was it Tom Cornell saying the work of being the anarch of the anarchist?
Well, I'll be glad to respond just from memory. I think a lot of people, particularly when they're young, come to the worker because they're interested in anarchism. I don't think most people came originally because they heard the word personalist. I think that's something you kind of have to learn when you're there. The Christian anarchism now seems to be enjoying a bold one. But in the traditional left, and I think probably the more traditional historians can speak to this, people do not think of the Catholic worker as animals. I mean, they would not put that in the camp because they don't have the traditional left, I don't think, has any concept of personalism. I don't see the Christian anarchism as such is really a strong strand in the worker. I think personalism is just from my non-academic kind of research.
You just say a word about that. The phrase Mel Malkin talked about, the phrase being introduced in the post-World War II years, and it got the Catholic worker involved in a lot of big ideological disputes on the American left, and I think it kind of went off the charts for that. But there is something very important, I think, in that anarchist tradition. I refer people, one of the most wonderful texts, I think, is Robert Coles' book at the end of Dorothy's life, all those reminiscences of Dorothy looking back over her life. Chapter 6 is called A Local Politics, and it's a wonderful, wonderful statement, I think, of a kind of view of politics that has some of its roots in the anarchist tradition, I think, and it's extremely useful for us. The most useful part, I think, is this tremendous suspicion of the use of the word state. If you summarized official teaching, it would be nonviolence as an option for individuals, but states have the right and indeed the obligation to defend their citizens by force if necessary. Gordon Zahn always used to say, now, this state, now, do we mean Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger or Lyndon Johnson and Dean Ruskin? So you understand? That criticism of the state, I think, was what made the anarchist discussion really important and is extremely valuable now to be skeptical about these ethical claims around the state.
Hi, my name is Carolyn. I'm from Carl Kevin House in St. Louis, and I see myself as one of the younger people that's come up here and talk, even though I'm not looking that young. I didn't hear that, someone's going to tell me. One historical current I see Steve that has spent time living in the Catholic Worker, is that there seems to be a movement now where just the community piece of the Catholic Worker is a big part of what we're looking for and what our somewhat evangelical message is. A lot of people that are coming, especially the young people, are talking about just how to live in the world, how to find a place that's sane, that's life-giving, how to make just a place where you can live and survive and feel well in how you're living in this world. And some of our speakers have talked about how to get our message out into the world. And I think that's important, but a big part of our message is just our community life. Is this a joyful, healing, life-giving place to be? If it is, all kinds of people want to be with us, Christian or not. And that's where kind of the humanism comes from, is that we've made this way to live that is worth living. And so much of my own journey has been, okay, how can I be a happy person in this world, in this time? And then bringing people, surrounding myself with people in a way of life that makes life good. And a doctor friend of mine who used to visit our community a lot said, you know, I've noticed in your community how many people struggle with some depression. That there's all these people in this Catholic Worker community that have, you know, in the community, not our guests, who also have mental illness, but that struggle with depression. And he said, you know, I think part of the reason you guys are all in this community is it's your way of surviving. And I thought that that was so true. So when I look at the history, I partly see all of these misfits coming together and finding a way that they can really live. And that includes the poor, it includes all of us. But I see the younger generation being all the more clear about how much that is a work of mercy in itself. Just making community, inviting the poor into it, but also doing that well for one another.
Thank you. Great.
I think that was wonderfully said and very revealing. I don't think it's something entirely new, because you do again have the quotes back in the 1930s, people talking about people came to serve, but in fact they were served as well. And for many back then, the Catholic Worker became a place where they were also healed, even as they were healing. The other thing I'd say is perhaps this may be a more contemporary reference, and again, I'm not as knowledgeable, but I do think in a world where so much pressure is on for individual achievements and people are judged by their resumes, it is quite striking to find communities where people are judged on the capacity for their faith, hope, and love, and where that is the decider for who you really are. And I think that even though not everyone would use that language, That's a quite appealing and strikingly countercultural phenomenon that may appeal to a lot more people than you would think in our current age.
Hello, I'm Chris Conestano from the Sheep Ranch Catholic Worker Firm, and I have a question for you scholars. It's not a question. It's a request. The farms have been a part of the movement that has not really been studied, and it would really be valuable to us to have a study of our farms and to know that history, because I want to share with you that in 1983, the Green Revolution discussion, there were four people. Yesterday, at the Green Revolution discussion, the room was overflowing, over 50 people. And it's one of the most valuable, I think, in today's ecological crisis. This part of the movement is so essential, and it would be such a help to us to have a study done. Thank you.
Maybe we'll take two or three comment questions and then let them.
Well, I think we live in a world, and this question is mainly posed to Dan, of moral ambiguity. Everywhere around us, well, maybe, but it's okay if you don't. But that's all right. I don't want to hurt your feelings. And I think the Catholic Worker is one of the places that isn't morally ambiguous. And there are children in this room, and I don't want them to hear the story of, you know, our interaction with soldiers and our meeting them with love, and think from your statement that that's because we're not, I'm not a pacifist, I'll speak for myself. And there is a woman who works at the Pentagon who I interact with every single Monday. And she gives the house cookies and toys for the children, and I write her thank you notes. And her cookies and toys don't make her a Catholic Worker, and my notes don't make me a part of the military. We're just two human beings who are trying to figure it out. And I hope that in my interactions with her, that something about my presence there is for love of Jesus and for the conversion of sinners and in reparation against the sins, you know, committed. Not because I'm not a pacifist, but because I'm trying to reach her in every venue that I have. And if a corporate person came who conflicted every kind of work of mercy, he came to my door and gave me lasagna or said, hey, can I come in and argue with you for a while? I wouldn't turn him out either, not because all of a sudden the works of mercy aren't valid, but because there's no other way to reach people but on the one to one sometimes. So that was rambling, but I think it's important. I think it's important for us to be consistent because there are so few places that are. And I think we owe it to the children in this room to maintain that safety and courage. Thank you.
One more and then we'll turn. You want to respond?
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I'm really delighted that I managed to say it in a provocative enough way. I certainly agree that the person who gives cookies once is not, by virtue of that, a Catholic Worker. I guess what I wonder, though, is how many times do they have to give the cookies before they become part of the Catholic Worker's story? And does the moment when they sort of cross the line into being a Catholic Worker need to coincide with the moment where they say, yes, I'm a pacifist now too? And I hope it's possible to have that kind of very valuable moral clarity that you're talking about at the same time as you have the ambiguity that people can't always tell when they've crossed the line to become part of the story.
I'm reminded of the late Father Dick McSorley of Georgetown, and founder of several Catholic Workers in Washington, D.C. I said, how do you start a Catholic Worker, Father? He said, it's simple. You just sign on a sign that says Catholic Worker.
Hi, I'm Anna from the Denver Catholic Worker, and I want to thank you, Dan, for the, I so enjoyed in your book the chapter about the evolution of the aims, means, and purposes, and I find myself wondering now, in some of the prior conversation about anarchism, so how does that need updating? How does it get updated? An anarchistic movement. Certainly there's plenty enough in aims, means, and purposes that it will keep us busy for the rest of our lives, but are there some things we'd like to add to that, and what might be the process if there are?
I wasn't very happy with my comments on anarchism because I think, and this is rather personal, I think probably many of us have had experience of for people for whom anarchism means, well, I don't clean the bathroom when I'm in the house, you could if you wanted to. But I want to tell just to kind of maybe, this might be a, well, we've got a couple more things, but John Ford was a little upset with the fact that nobody ever did the work. This is probably 1935. So he said to Dorothy, well, why don't we just have a little simple chore list and say, you know, that everyday people need to kind of read their beds and sweep the floor. So he put up a little list. Well, guess who took it down? Dorothy Day.
Yes.
I'm Mike Baxter from the South Bend Catholic Network, and I wanted to make a comment and then see if I could elicit a response or continue the debate that you are instigating. The thing that I'm worried about with historians, as David was, is that historians are governed by, they do their work out of narratives, and that I feel like I could elicit in each of your comments or the books that you've written a kind of a nationalist narrative that really works at cross purposes with the Catholic program. I loved Mel's book when I read it in 1984, and but at the very end, it refers to the Catholic program in the past tense as a moment that, as a movement that had great importance. And as I look back at the book, I could see that it was governed by a paradigm that would put the worker in a sect type, according to Charles's paradigm. And I feel like that the book was working to get out of that, but couldn't. So often I think that's an intellectual form of what we meet up with a lot, which is, well, you guys are great voices to have, but not effective. Whereas I think we want to look at it and say, we want to be fruitful rather than effective, and that takes us other places. And I feel, too, in locating Dorothy in the radical tradition, is very important. Obviously, she came out of that. But it was a great pain for her to leave that. And so part of her story, her narrative, is to love the people she worked with when she was young, but to also feel the pain of the distance. And she really, I think, carried that in her heart her whole life. Why? Well, I think she felt called to God. And that for her, the way she writes the long loneliness is an Augustinian narrative, starts out with confession, ends up with the Eucharist, and that really for her is strong personal narrative, but also I think a narrative that's the only narrative capable of resisting the nationalist narrative of the state. And that's why I'm wary of the idea of the works of mercy, which I guess we'll get a lot of talk, because the way I would read that is that's a form of Protestant liberalism which separates doctrine, reduces everything to ethics, and is another form of accommodation of the state. And I feel like Dorothy was working out of a narrative and Catholic social teaching which said the modern problem is statism. And the only way to resist it is God. And that, so for her, I think that was what gave her the resources to resist the subtle encroachments of the modern state, especially subtle with the modern liberal state. And I don't think this means anything about closing people off or judging people. She struggled with that constantly. But it is a way to say that, like she would put it, if we look at life on the natural plane, it will close itself off. And only when we dive to that and open ourselves out to the supernatural do we have the resources we need to glorify God in all that we do. And then I think when we look at it historically, that it's important to be mindful of these conditions. Anyway, that's a long.
Yeah, that's the wonderful comments, Mike. Thank you so much. That's a really important piece over against, I think, the perspective that many of us on the panel share. Would you say that Dorothy's narrative
is the only way to resist the state. I think the implication of that is that people like Ammon Hennessy and Karl Meyer lack the resources to resist the state because they depart from her narrative in a fundamental way. And so it's essentially, I think what you're doing is driving a wedge right down the middle of the Catholic worker. No, okay, good. I hope you'll come back to me on that. On this, I think, is why the American anarchist tradition that Ammon Hennessy did so much to bring into the Catholic worker story is important. Because people like William Lloyd Garrison and Aidan Ballou were pioneering techniques of radical nonviolence and resisting the state on the basis of a God they felt they could discover entirely in the individual heart without need for the organized church. And Hennessy, more than Karl Meyer, you know, would also be in that kind of theological tradition, as would I. And that's all I need to say right now. That's kind of where the lines are drawn.
This is a great note I'm going to draw to a close. Michael says we should close down for the morning and get our lunch. I want to say a couple things. One is that Michael Baxter and I have had five or six times had unfinished conversations about this. I call myself the last Catholic Americanist, and I'm going to try in the next year or so before I die to relaunch an Americanist movement, but that's another story for another day. Let me say three quick things that I think are encouraging that grow out of kind of my travels. One is that starting tonight in Philadelphia, an event will take place called the Common Good Convention. It was put together and facilitated by a remarkable group of young Catholics who have tried to recapture the church's public discourse from the Catholic right that hijacked it in 2004. They've worked for 4 years building networks of support around the country, building up a financial support. They've got a thing called the Catholic Media Report you can pick up online. They've got a quick reaction to kind of untruths that come from the Catholic right. Wonderful, wonderful group. And they facilitated a meeting in Philadelphia that brought together people from 20 or so Catholic networks around the country, the Common Good Convention. Pax Christi is there for its annual meeting. They will produce a Common Good Manifesto this weekend, which I hope people will pick up, that builds on the Bishop's Faithful Citizenship, but with a sharper edge to it and a clearer focus on the common good. It's a great event. Over 800 people registered for it by mail before the opening tonight, so please hold them in prayer. Another thing to just keep an eye on, I'm sure many of you are aware of, is the Catholic Mennonite Dialogue, which has produced, after many years, a remarkable, remarkable document called Called Together to be Peacemakers, which was cleared by the Vatican, and if I understand it correctly, is a tremendous breakthrough that locates nonviolence as the church position, as the Christian position, with just war being a rare, extremely rare kind of exception or possibility. It really relocates the Catholic discussion, I think, in a remarkable way. And thirdly is the Catholic Peacebuilding Network, put together by the Catholic Relief Services, the Mennonites, and the Kroc Center at Notre Dame. I know in some ways they haven't kind of invited in some of the radical edge of peacemaking in the United States, but the people in that network, in the Philippines, in Africa, in Colombia, are really on the ground building peace in ways that echo all the themes and concerns of the Catholic worker movement. Absolutely heroic people in these situations of great jeopardy. So you can Google Catholic Peace Building Network, try to keep track of the work. Those three things, I think, are all signs of real hope and real possibility for us. My closing remark would just be that Mel said something about if you're from God or you're not from God will depend. This room, when I came to Worcester, hosted the largest bingo game in New England on a weekly basis. And bingo is not held here anymore, so I guess. And we're here, and 50 years from now or 100 years from now, people will look back on this Catholic worker gathering in this hall and say it surely was the work of God. Thank you all, and thank you to our panel.
Thank you, David. Thanks, everybody. That was fantastic. We're going to have a couple more announcements and one statement, and then we'll break for lunch. Kathy Boylan said, are we going to take a group photo? Which is an awesome idea. And we are going to take a group photo. Bob Fitch is going to take a photo of everybody. Bob Fitch, skilled photographer. On that lawn, the lawn out that door, at 1 o'clock, 1 o'clock sharp. He's going to set up on a ladder and everything, I think. If you know somebody who's not in this room, tell them 1 o'clock sharp on that lawn. It'd be great to get everybody a photo. Is Etta still here? Etta, has a brief announcement about the lawn.
Hi, I'm
Maddie
Pedorn from Dorothy Catholic Worker DC. And speaking of nonviolence, we've had some very good, fruitful discussion on H.R. 362, the bill to blockade Iran's ports, co-sponsored by 200 of our representatives. And it would, again, be the first, constituted as the first act of war against Iran. So what we've done is a statement has emerged, and we are going to distribute that statement after this conference. So we have an email list, it's called the Iran Working Group, on the like sign up and registration thing. If you like that statement, we can email or mail it to you. And then we're hoping people distribute it in their neighborhoods, and we're gonna pick like a week to go and tell our representatives locally that we do not support going to war with Iran. And that's coming out of the Catholic Worker Gathering. So that's it, bless you, thanks for your time.
Somebody found a $10 bill outside the restroom.
Oh, yeah.
If you can prove, if you can tell me the serial number. This is yours. One last
thing. I'll help my 50.
If anyone's interested in talking about foreclosures, I'm going to be doing that at 1:30. See if there are people interested in a discussion group. And I just wanted to add, I'm going to make this short and not follow the tradition of turning a question into a speech. But I think it's important that we don't confuse the Catholic Worker with just the left, because there are so many things that we have in common with things that are often seen as right values, such as the right to life and the seamless garment part, and personal morality and distributism. It's a radical approach. And the thing that attracted me to the Worker more than anything was Peter's idea of taking the dynamite of the Gospels and unwrapping them and bring them into modern day society. And so I think Dorothy would say prayer and faithfulness and truthfulness are really at the heart of this. And I think also we have to avoid being too self-congratulatory. Well, this is a living movement, and we need to keep growing. So thank you very much.